Welcome to Influential Visions. Here, we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open.
Hello, everybody. It's lovely to see you all. And today we're joined by Nicholas Babin, who is the author of The Talking Dog. And if you don't know him, he's quite influential in the tech space, but it's great to see everyone, really.
Thank you, Nat. Hello, everyone.
Hi, all.
Hiya.
So we're going to talk about demystifying technology. I know that there's been a lot of change in the past few years. It's accelerated dramatically. And, you know, who better to kind of talk about this than you guys, really, to be honest. So I'm privileged to have you here and really looking forward to kicking off this series now with you guys.
Me too. It's great to be part of the team. And Nicholas, always a joy to have you on. And I know it's going to be really insightful. So how are we going to get started? I wonder if, to start us off, we think about where did you first find your journey into technology? And I'm going to start, Nicholas, with you, please.
Okay, great. Thank you for prompting the question. So technology has been an old story for me. Back in 1989, I found myself in California, in the Silicon Valley in San Francisco, around San Francisco. And for the first time ever, I mean, somebody gave me a CompuServe disk, a CD at the time. Well, not even CD, sorry, floppy disk. and they said, oh, you'll see, just install it. It's very easy. So, you know, on the very slow computers that we used to have, the IBM ones. So put the floppy disk and you had this system that would come up and you could share at the time recipes with other people around California, but other people who had internet. I mean, the first level of internet was not even called internet. And we thought, wow, that could be fantastic. You know, like, wow, if you can share recipes, then you can share documents, then you can start. So you have to think that, you know, number one, you had modems, and you probably all remember the horrible sound that these did. And most of the time, like 90% of the time, it would never connect. And you had very slow computers. So it was really hard to start working on this new technology. But then you could see the potential behind it. So for me, it was when I first started it. Then I was working for a French bank in San Francisco, and I installed the first email system. I mean, you have to remember, it was only fax at the time, right? Yay. So I remember coming in the morning in the bank and people would be like, Nicholas, you can't believe it. We received an email from Paris. Woohoo! Now it's funny, of course. But at the time, you know, it was the first time ever. And so carry on from there, you know, I started working for Sony and I was in charge of the first GPS system. The talking car, the title of the talking dog. So I went from talking car to a talking dog, because then I went to AI and robotics, and I was in charge of all the artificially intelligence and robots for Sony. So I was, for me, I've been extremely lucky. You know, we're talking here about new technologies, but I've been really involved with new technologies from when I was very young, well, over 20, so younger than today anyway, all the way to new technologies today, being involved with NFT, with blockchain, AI. I'm a veteran of AI because I've been using AI since 1996. And so that's why it you know, your subject today is very keen for me. I mean, at least I'm very keen to talk about it and to demystify the angle. That's why I did in my book, when it's called The Talking Dog, Immersion in New Technologies, because I wanted to speak about all the things we hear all the time today, and metaverse being one. It's not in the book, metaverse, because when I launched the book, it was not yet launched, but I did talk about Second Life and things like that. So that, you know, the reason why I'm so excited to be here today.
Oh, fabulous. What a great journey. And I remember those days when I first started out in banking, and you'd have to go and get your faxes and then pass them around. And I remember the chaos of when we actually introduced the email system, and I was the email trainer at the time.
All right.
And it was, yeah, it still could make me go grey overnight thinking about how awful it was. And yet now you can't imagine it, can you? You know, I chat to my little girl and you see her and her little friends like, yeah, seriously, are you lot ancient? I mean, I remember my first ever thing with a computer being the very old original Amstrad when I think I was about 10 or 11, and you had to get you got the book, didn't you, and had to sit and code it.
Yep. I had the Sinclair ZX81, an English computer. And yep. Let me tell you, I had hair at the time, but you see, it disappeared very quickly after that.
Yeah, it wasn't. I remember the ZX Spectrum. In fact, embarrassingly, I once put on my friend's CV, and she'd got excellent computer skills, and she went, I haven't. I was like, you're pretty good at Centipede. I'm not sure you'd get away with that now, but
no.
It was a lot of years ago, so I think we were able to. Nish, can you also share with us your journey, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of came into technology a little bit later than you, Nicholas. But by the time I started working, we were using emails, for example, but it was all to do with, I came into data. So it was all about using data in banking. And at the time, you know, I thought that, you know, I'd be there for a couple of months, not really staying in that world. But just how that kind of universe blew up and how data started really being shared within banks and the power of that really kept me in that world. And I started building technologies for back office banking solutions. And it was, to me, it was incredible, like the kind of how spreadsheet driven, how kind of backward it was, that all of these huge corporations just didn't have the infrastructure to, number one, support the transference of data, transference of documentation. It was all very much the front office focus. So all of the trading stuff was all very elite and very up to date. But all of the back office systems to support all of that was just breaking, because it was people and spreadsheets and passing faxes around. And, you know, we had really terrible email systems that we used in banking when I first started. And all of that had to be upgraded. Even that upgrade process, moving from one system to another, that was a huge process that took years. It took years to migrate an email system back then, just because of the sheer volume of people and data that was being transferred. And it was the thing that was the biggest issue was how people didn't really understand the scope of that project. And so they'd say, yeah, I can do it in 6 months, should be fine, but didn't realize how much they didn't know about what they were doing. So it was those kind of projects that I started working on. And yeah, it was, and then trying to build a system and make that sort of what I call sticky. So come and work with users and talk through how it is that they would then utilize the next system. So all of that training that you talk about, Kim, that had to be done. But you didn't think about that, because it was okay, fine, we're building this system and the users know about it, right? But they didn't know about it, because it would have been a top level executive that brought a system in, and the people who were using it had no idea about it. So it was that, and then they didn't use it, and it was all of that kind of fun stuff. So that's kind of been my journey to even where I am today, which is building technology solutions, bespoke really technology solutions for people who want what they're asking for, but they still don't really know how to accept what they've asked for. But I would be interested to finding out from Nicholas, actually, what do you think the key thing is? So, you know, we all are sat in a generation where we've seen no internet versus where we are today, which is accelerated growth. What would you say is the key accelerant, I would say, from somebody who has no technology to accepting that technology? What do you think the key driver of accepting technology would be that you've seen?
Well, it has changed quite a lot. The first key driver has been, you know, being curious and looking at what's available and trends coming up, and people thinking, you know, I sound a bit stupid if I don't know what emails are, you know, like, long time ago, definitely. lately, what I've seen, and that's one of the big change, is our environment has made people change. COVID has been a huge driver for me for, and on the plus side, literally on the benefit side, because, you know, people suddenly found themselves in lockdowns, and they wanted to communicate. They still wanted to have their lives back, if I could say. In France, we've been locked down many times, and you know, you still wanted to talk to your children, even if they were far away or things like that. And so you had to move. I mean, you know, obviously I was already using all the tools that we see today, like the Zooms, like the Teams and things like that. But people who were not using them, they had to get involved with these tools and embrace new technologies. So to me, it's all about mindset, you know, and we talk a lot about digital transformation and things like that. Yes, it has definitely moved on with the fact that new technology is now more available and everything, but it's all about people, you know, and it needs to be all about people. I talked about artificial intelligence in the beginning. You know, it's when I first launched Aibo, the first dog, AI dog, robotic dog, at least people were scared because they think, well, is it going to replace me? I had somebody in the Trafford Center in Manchester who ripped Aibo's head off because said, I'm scared of robots. I don't want to see robots in my life. So now we can laugh about it. And at the time, I didn't laugh. It was a 2,000-pound product. My dog was killed. But today, you know, it's all about mindset change. And that's what's so critical, is for people to understand that technology is at their service, not the other way around. And that's why we see technologies that are being embraced more, like artificial, like AI, obviously, but that also virtual realities, AR. When we talk about metaverse today, and Mark Zuckerberg talking about metaverse, he did it because it's at the right time, and because also technology is mature to allow this. It wouldn't have happened 2 years ago because we were not ready. But because COVID came, so people decided to start changing their mindset around new technologies. And because the technology is available, then you can see new things happening. So to go back to your question, and as a summary, I would say, you know, 30 years ago, people would change because it was trendy, because they could see a benefit in their lives, even though it was, you know, change management was hard. But today, the biggest thing is change management is still hard, but people are embracing and changing because they have to, because they're back to the wall, because, you know, we had this pandemic.
Very so good. True, isn't it?
So. Oh. Sorry, I agree completely with what you're saying there, Nicholas. And I feel kind of dwarfed by all of you guys and all your experience, because I kind of came into technology via social media, really, and selling beer on Twitter actually was how I became a social media influencer originally. And I managed to sell beer to the largest independent pub chain in the United Kingdom, which had thousands of outlets. Back about 12 years ago, when I found myself out of work. And through there, I kind of basically ended up building a reputation within the technology space. And then IBM actually asked me to attend a round table to discuss AI in jobs, which is interesting. And Nicholas made me think about that a minute ago. And from that point, I suppose I just immersed myself in new technologies and trying to understand what was happening and really the innovation that is occurring right now in terms of like productivity over the next few years. They actually think that right now we're at the bottom of the curve in terms of creating more productive lives. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be fantastic the next few years, I think. And, the way that life is changing for people, the way that we have all this data and we're actually managing to analyze it, it's incredible. But I think that the people element and actually is so important. And, you know, integrating the people with the process and the technology is what is really going to make all of this work and cement everything together, in my opinion.
Yep, couldn't agree more.
So I guess I was going to say at the point I leapt in, I think it is that whole piece around people, isn't it? You know, very often when I've been involved in kind of transformational change, they'll have thought about the process and they'll have thought about the system and the infrastructure, but they will have forgotten that every single element of it hits people. And I think, you know, Nish, you were saying before about the, you know, the technology, the back office parts of banks can be really pretty poor. And I think that's because very often we focus on what's going out, you know, to other people. I remember working at Egg years ago, and they were deemed to be very, very innovative and forward thinking. And we were one of the first to deliver your decision on a loan within 24 hours. And that was deemed back then to be amazing. But if you'd been where I was, which was the team that rang you to say you'd been successful, the behind the scenes piece beggared belief. I mean, you'd go online, you'd fill in your form, it'd ping across to India, where they would actually update it into a system that pinged across to Dudley, that then went into for the underwriters, that came across to me as an Excel spreadsheet that I then converted into a dialable file to ring up and go, congratulations, you've been successful. And we had a 12-hour window to get all of that done to enable the paperwork to go out in the post to hit our 24-hour deadline. And you were thinking, actually, you know, on the outside, often it was like a swan, and underneath they'd be like peddling like mad trying to get these things done. And, like, you know, in my career, I've seen some horrendous things because people didn't understand the implication of where their piece of transformation ended. I remember working for one major bank who had risk accepted that they would use a macro on an Excel spreadsheet whilst they were waiting for the implementation of a new system. And I joined 14 years later, and they were still using that macro. They were still waiting for that system, but nobody had gone back and checked. It was no longer known that that's what they were doing. And so the world had moved on. When it was set up, they operated 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. And by the time I got there, they operated 7 days a week, as we know. But the problem is the macro didn't. So actually, unless you actually talked to that particular part of the organization between 9 and 5, Monday to Friday, it didn't do what it was supposed to do because it wasn't part of the macro. And it cost, I think it was £23 million in redress because of that one mistake, because people didn't go back. And you kind of think, in today's world — that was relatively recent — in today's world, the fact that we've still got massive organizations that are so complex with their technology that they have still got pockets like that that are being unpicked. Is that something that you guys have seen in kind of your journeys, in your career?
Well, I've been — when I was writing some articles for Oracle around ERP systems, I did masses of research into that, and you wouldn't believe, the internet is strewn with stories of badly implemented ERP systems that, in fact, if the people, the process and the technology had worked in harmony, they would have managed to implement the system right in an effective way and not lose money and have to revert back to their back office system that was 20 years old, but it still worked. You know, it's bonkers. You know, I don't know. What do you think about that, Nish?
No, absolutely. And I think that the sad thing about it is the products are fantastic. The ERP systems in on their own are brilliant. You know, they do exactly what they say they will. They are hugely if you've built the right integrations, then they're absolutely fantastic. But it's all of that kind of process where you take it in and you say, right, you're going from this system to this system, and then you start chopping and changing it, and it's saying, okay, well, those people in that department are really embedded with their kind of spreadsheet process or whatever it is, so we can't change that bit, so let's just chunk that bit out of it. And then they start chopping and changing it, and the whole thing becomes just a lot more different to what the actual product intended. And at some point, even the product says, we're going to pedal the product consultants who are coming in from the, you know, the product, those, the ERP systems, Salesforce, the SAPs, whoever it is in the world. These brilliant systems who are now innovating on top of their brilliant product, even though they haven't actually been implemented correctly in customers. They're sort of bringing their consultants out of it, saying, do you know what, actually, now this is your problem because you've completely kind of created this beast within your organization that we kind of don't really want to know about. We'll hand it back over to you, and then you can spend money to do whatever changes you want to. So it is, I've absolutely seen that. And you know, then I would have come in with a new technology, and you've got all of the users who are sitting there saying, oh, do you know what? We had this 3 years ago, they brought this product in, and now you're coming in to replace it. So we know how this is going to go. So you've got that fatigue and disillusionment. So it's really down to getting that delivery cycle, understanding what that means in terms of, you know, the iterative process, you know, building things in small increments to make sure that people are actually taking on and accepting the change in a small process, which is you know. And then you've got that in those large corporations, which is why it's baffling to me how 5 years ago I didn't want to have an iPhone. I didn't want one because I liked my BlackBerry, I liked all the buttons, but I was able to switch just like that because, exactly to what Nicholas said, I needed FaceTime. I was living abroad at the time, and I was like, oh, do you know what, FaceTime's got the best application to speak to my family when I live abroad, so I'm going to switch to an iPhone, and I've never looked back. I've always had iPhones now. So it's things like that where, how do you replicate that urgency for change within a corporate organization? That's something that I'm still sort of trying to work out, really.
I think everything you've all been saying is very true, but the common denominator of all this is user experience or employee experience. It's really all about personalization of experience. Something that, honestly, when I first started in marketing, we didn't have. And at the time, I used this sentence regularly. It's like we used to spray and pray, you know, spray messages and pray that somebody will get your message. Today, you don't do that anymore. I mean, the email marketing is still going on, but it's not as effective as it used to be. What we see is really projects that work are projects where they put humans at the center and experience with that human being or that human experience, if I could say. And this is where I have experienced myself some projects that have totally failed because the CEO and the CFO, sorry, were the two people who were driving the that was pre-COVID. I want to be totally transparent on this. But the CEO and the CFO were saying, this is the KPIs we want, this is the ROIs we want, and this is how our project needs to evolve. Well, again, if the employees didn't agree to that, if the users or the consumers, you know, your clients didn't agree to that, then it would fail, even if you put tons of money behind it. And I've seen it. I've seen it with very large companies that decided, yeah, this is the way we're going to go. And behind, nobody would agree to this. And people will actually talk badly about it inside the company. And as a consultant, you look at this and you think, oh, well, that's a challenge, because now you need to get the management to agree to open up and make sure that everybody behind will be on board, exactly as Nish said. I mean, just before COVID, like 3 months before the first lockdown, I had a CEO of a very large French company telling me that with him as a CEO, he will never, ever, ever agree to working from home, to a strategy of working from home, ever. That to him, it was a strategy that will allow people to take vacations when actually, you know, they will be at home doing nothing. I so badly wanted to call him during the first lockdown thing. Are you still the CEO or have you changed your mind, mate? Well, I didn't do it, obviously. I'm not that courageous. But, you know, and this is, again, part of experience, mindset, and technology at your service. And we're going back to the same point, but I think this is what you were all saying, you know, big projects, a lot of money, and sometimes it works when you take in consideration people who are going to make it a success sometimes it doesn't work because you are a bit stubborn and you decide to go your own way.
But that's so true though, isn't it? Because I know, you know, I worked for quite a lot of the big banks, and for years they were trying to find out how could they embrace perhaps a little bit more work from home, particularly those that were based out of Canary Wharf that were running out of real estate and didn't know where to fit it. But the concerns were always, could it be done? Could you do it securely? Could you do it for all levels of the bank, or would it only ever be certain levels of seniority? And then obviously COVID happened and overnight they were forced into it. They had to do it. But it reminds me a little bit of Roger Bannister when he did the 4-minute mile. You know, he was the first person to do it. But how many people did it within a month of him doing it? Because actually he'd now proved that it was doable. And I think it's those parts, isn't it? It's that mindset shift that says suddenly the impossible became possible. And then now actually people are embracing it and finding that it gives them better balance and they're able to see that real benefit, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And impossible, there's a big saying in French coming from Napoleon. So a long time ago, he said impossible is not French. And at the time, that was the mindset. Unfortunately, we lost that. Somewhere, anywhere, and it's not the case anymore. And you're right. When somebody shows you that it is possible, then people behind it just go for it and actually improve it. You know, it's really funny. I mean, I'm sorry. I know you three are English, but I have to say that the Six Nations just finished, and a French guy, and I thought that was so un-French, but that's why I'm repeating it, said the English have invented rugby, and we've managed to improve it. Which is exactly the story behind it. You know, we didn't think it was possible to do this grand slam. I mean, here is a different, obviously, analogy, but it's exactly what it is. You show that it is possible, then you get people behind to believe in it. So whether it's with influencers or things like that, but it becomes like then the norm, and the norm is then improved. And this is the journey. You know, everything is a journey. So you have ups and downs, and failure is part of the journey. But here you find yourself in a journey of accepting that you can do something. That's the number one point. And the number two is like, once you've reached that, you can improve it.
Yeah, absolutely. And excuse me. And Kim and I, we were talking about scope creep. She taught me all about that the other week. And I thought it was fascinating, actually, because the way that organizations just, you know, influential people come along in the board and say, well, we just need this feature. We just want that function. And then they add it all on together. And then the project fails. And then it's like, well, yeah, it's the technology company's fault. And I just found that a really eye-opening conversation. I learned so much from talking with you about that, Kim. It was super.
Thank you. But I think that's the thing, isn't it? I think with all of these things, and Nicholas, you said it at the start, Nish, you've said it throughout, Nat, you've also concurred, it comes down to the people, because actually, you know, the users are all people. So everyone wants to feel a little bit unique. And you know, I worked in lots of places where I go, yeah, but that's okay, but we're different because we're more complicated, which is why, Nish, to your point, they take these great ERP systems and then they kind of like go, yeah, but it needs to do this bit for me. And it always reminds me of that episode of The Simpsons with Homer's car, you know, where he makes it so much like his car that actually he's the only person in the world that's ever going to want to buy it. And I think that's what we do, isn't it? Because we're listening to everybody's individual point of view, trying to bring them into it. And then you realize that actually it doesn't all work, because what we've not done is found a common ground and said, what is it that we're trying to achieve? And how do we restate that intention? How do we make sure that we take the people on the journey first and bring the technology along with us, as opposed to take the technology there and then leave them feeling like they're running to catch up, which very often seems to be the thing that makes them not want to accept the change, and almost, and I think Nicholas, you were saying this, almost try and find a way to make it fail. Try and find a way to say shouldn't have happened in the first place, because actually we were fine beforehand, before they did this.
I mean, absolutely. You mentioned Homer Simpson, Kim. And also there's two things with which Homer Simpson has always inspired me on. That car episode where he builds his car and it's the worst car in the world. And also when he thinks he's going to die and he goes through the grief curve and the Kubler-Ross change curve, effectively. Those are two things I always have in my mind when I'm building a new technology, or you're faced with somebody who's absolutely not going to use a new technology. And it's absolutely that. It's appealing to people's sense of what, even their values. Like, it comes down to such real foundational elements when you're changing something, even in what's as mundane or corporate and sort of professional as a system or within a corporate environment. It comes down to saying, look, do you know that it really takes a lot of time from you, which is time away from getting home early or whatever it is, when you can't do this thing in this way. And you have to really, what they talk about is transition theory, where you have to take people from one side, take them through the middle of that bridge, and then take them to the end of it. And that's all about that journey and appealing to people's to say, look, don't you want to cut your days shorter so that you can get home earlier to spend time with your family? Don't you want to sort of do this really mundane task really quickly so that you can spend more time at work doing things that you're passionate about, you know, the committees, the innovation streams, things like that. So yeah, you end up having to really, it's a psychology game at some point, because you have all of these meetings to try and ultimately change people and influence people to doing what you need them to do. And that's why actually I think that even to your point, Nicholas, that idea of being first starters or market leaders, that is what social media is doing right at the moment. It's telling you, the people get given, you know, a new phone, a new car, and you put it out to all of the influencers on social media. And it's like, if that guy's doing it, then I can probably do it as well. Or it starts appealing to people's sense of self and who they want to or they aspire to be. So there's a huge amount of people psychology behind change, and it's super interesting. And I think that, you know, we talk about the metaverse. I'm in the camp where I observe this of myself. I'm still sitting there thinking, really? Like, people sitting with, you know, VR kind of headsets on, buying whatever they need to, or going places and doing things. But I can see, you mentioned as well, like Nicholas, about it happening at the right time. COVID almost had to happen for that to even become a conversation piece, right? Because suddenly, you're watching football matches with no people, you know, when they took all the people out of the stadiums, and there was that whole drive to put the noise in because people wanted to watch the television to make people still feel as if there was an atmosphere, even though there wasn't. Well, if you take that one step further and you give them an Oculus or whatever it is, and they're there, suddenly, why do I need to buy a ticket to it? Ticket to a football match, I can do it from home. So yeah, it's mind-boggling what the implications of all of that is, really.
Very true. Just one last question, because I know we're a bit tight on time and we've run over a couple minutes. So just quickly, starting with Nicholas, what are you most excited about in terms of the next level of technology that's coming and on the way?
What I'm most excited about is the fact that I have no idea what's coming out of the way. I'm sorry to be that blunt, but it's true. You know, looking 2 years back, we had no idea that what we see today. So I'm going to answer your question. I was just trying to make a point, is that, you know, it's the next 5 years is going to be, and that's the exciting bit, is we see things that we know is going to be fantastic, but we have no idea what's next. But the things that I'm really excited about, and that's, for example, is the metaverse. For me, I think it's fantastic. The reason why I'm so excited about it is because in 2000, Sony came out with Home, which was actually at the same time as Second Life. So we had our own Second Life. Technology was not ready. You basically had a lot of problems because you would walk into a city or things like that, and it was not really engaging. What I can see today is, as I mentioned, is the fact that all these technologies are now mature. You have what I call gamification, the use of game mechanics in order to engage, be loyal to a brand, be loyal to a product. So all this is, we've been talking about this. I mean, gamification, I started talking about this in 2004, you know, so it's been going on for a long time. Again, virtual reality. I had the PlayStation 3, and we had our first games in virtual reality. So the PlayStation 3 was, I was still working with Sony at the time. So you're talking 2006, 2007. So all these technologies have now been around a long time. And so it makes people feel more comfortable with them. What I'm most excited about is what I see, you know, with autonomous cars, with smart cities, something that I work a lot today with smart energy, something that because we need to start thinking about, yeah, great, these new technologies are fantastic, but what's the impact on our planet and our environment? And with new technologies, for example, 5G, we thought about environment first. 6G is mainly about the environment and how we can save our planet, right? So today, that's the thing, is tech for good. You know, how can we use technology for the best of humanity and of the environment? And that's what excites me the most.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So how about you, Nish?
What I'm excited about, I am excited about sort of the potential for things like the metaverse. I think that things like, you know, it is a very human thing to, you know, run off and do something amazing. You know, we did it with plastic, but then you realize how terrible that is for the planet. But this idea that you do have a responsible, sort of note to all of the technology that's being driven forward. And if that means that sort of pulling back in the, you know, data transference of everything and making sure it's actually something that people can get on board with slightly slower, but maybe that helps the planet a little bit more, that does excite me. So I think it's something that a sustainable technology strategy is something that, yeah, I'm excited about for sure.
Thank you very much. And lastly, but not leastly, Kim, how about you? What's your take?
I think you guys have already summed it up. It's the what's next and the fact that that's unknown. And I love that. You know, you know, I say it all the time. My nan always used to say, you know, every day is a school day. And she's right. You know, every day we learn something new that we didn't know yesterday. And I'm excited to see the world that my little girl will grow up in. Like, it'll be fascinated to see what it might be like when she's my age and what changes she will have seen and I will have seen alongside her. But I just think, you know, there's so much opportunity for us to make things easier for people to be able to really focus on the things that are important. And I think also seeing how technology can help has helped people that are suffering with illnesses and things, and how we can help it to help people who are facing poverty, because I think there's a great opportunity for technology to be helping us improve the world for all, not just for the few. And what excites me is we're seeing some real breakthroughs in that, and I'd love to see what comes next in that space.
Thank you. Well, I agree with everything that you have all said. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate you. See you soon.
Thanks very much for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And